Good day. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, February 20th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead, they aren't native to the United States, yet Burmese pythons are providing to be quite the problem in parts of the nation. We take a look at how they got here.
Plus, after years of planning, an orchard in Fayetteville begins to spread its roots this afternoon. And students at an area junior high school prepare to put their knowledge and problem-solving skills to the test on the statewide arena.
But first, for the second day in a row, the Arkansas House failed to pass a bill renewing funding for the private option.
Cast with the balance, 68 yeas, 27 nays, one present, the bill fails.
It lost two votes yesterday compared to Tuesday's initial vote. A 3/4 margin is needed for approval. House Speaker Davy Carter says his chamber will try again today, with the state Senate also expected to take its first vote on the appropriation. Some lawmakers, including Republican Representative Bob Ballinger, argued they want an alternative to the current program, which uses federal funds to buy private insurance for low-income Arkansans.
We're working to try to do everything we can to find a plan that would be something that would bring some consensus, that would bring the lack of and be an alternative to, you know, the bully politics. And what I'd really like to see is a situation where we may be able to sit down and create an alternative that later on will enable some new ideas to come to this program.
Governor Beebe says proposed changes aren't realistic. Some legislative leaders say if the Senate passes it, passage of the bill's current version could be more possible in the House.
The hearing date has been set for a lawsuit seeking to strike down Arkansas's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. The case will be heard in Pulaski Circuit Court on April 17th. The lawsuit, Wright versus State of Arkansas, was filed 8 months ago by Cheryl Maples, a Searcy County attorney. Though the suit was originally filed on behalf of lead plaintiff Kendall Wright and her spouse Julia Wright, Maples now represents 43 named individuals who are challenging the ban. Maples has until the end of February to file a motion for summary judgment.
We're asking the court to rule on the existing law, both federal and state constitutional issues, and on our facts as alleged. Our facts are not being challenged, so everything should be in front of the court right now, and all of the facts that they need, all of the law that the court needs, and the court should be able to just go ahead and rule rather than have a big trial and witnesses and exhibits and all that. Everything should be right there for the court to rule upon.
The lawsuit challenges seven county clerks for refusing to issue marriage licenses, as well as the state of Arkansas for the ban. Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel is representing the state in the case to be heard by Pulaski County Circuit Judge Chris Piazza. 17 states allow gay marriage, and three other states, including Oklahoma, have stayed their bans, pending hearings in federal circuit courts.
But in our case, since we filed in state court, we go to the Arkansas Supreme Court,
which will decide the case. If they lose, the plaintiffs will have to rely on pending federal cases and the U.S. Supreme Court to rule in their favor. Last summer, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, resulting in federal recognition of legally married same-sex couples. But that ruling stopped short of declaring a U.S. constitutional right to marry, leaving the issue for states to decide.
According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau and calculations from the Northwest Arkansas Council, the population of Northwest Arkansas is growing by about 23 people a day. Following that growth rate, the council predicts the metro area will welcome its 500,000th resident in August. Rob Smith, communications director for the Northwest Arkansas Council, says the growth rate is something to celebrate.
It is growth. It's not the growth we saw in the previous decade. It's really we were more like 30 people a day, but we think we've maybe gained a little momentum now. We were at 23 in this measure, and we're pretty excited about the fact that the Census Bureau will come out with new estimates, and it will show us what our growth was and our number was at July of 2013. So we'll be able to kind of recalculate and see if we're still growing at 23 or maybe we're growing a tad faster than that.
He says the growth rate is a boon for the area's economy.
We know companies want to place themselves, find success, and to do that, they need to be in places that are growing. What we found, if you really look at these 23 people a day, is they're really coming to all of our communities. Bentonville, Bella Vista, Rogers, Springdale, and Fayetteville are all adding people every single day. Out of the 38 communities that I calculated in this estimate, there were only four that were losing population. They were very, very small communities.
He says in terms of the individual cities, Fayetteville and Springdale each add roughly four people a day to their population, while Rogers and Bentonville each add between three and four people a day. That means 15 out of the 23 new residents per day move to one of the area's four big cities.
Walmart says it will build double the number of small format stores this fiscal year than previously announced. According to the CityWire, the retailer this morning expanded its original capital forecast provided in October and expects to add between 270 and 300 small stores during the fiscal year, double the initial forecast of 120 to 150 stores. In comparison, Walmart U.S. is expected to continue its plan to open 115 new supercenters this year.
The news of more small-format stores comes on the heels of Walmart's fourth-quarter financial report. According to Talk Business Arkansas, the company's fourth-quarter revenue grew from $127.8 billion a year ago to $128.8 billion this year. But net income shrank from roughly $5.9 billion last year to $4.4 billion in the recently completed quarter.
The Razorback swimming and diving team moved up to fifth place yesterday in the SEC Championships in Athens, Georgia. In yesterday's competition, two more school records were shattered. Sophomore Anna Mayfield broke the record in the 500 freestyle, set in 2011 by former Razorback All-American Chelsea Franklin. Meanwhile, junior Susanna White broke the school record for the 50 freestyle, a record she had set earlier in the championship's preliminary rounds. Competition continues today in Athens.
Mostly clear tonight, lows between 28 and 31. Sunshine tomorrow, highs from 60 to 64. Tomorrow night, clear, lows around 37. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from Little Rock is Roby Brock. He is the man behind Talk Business Arkansas. He has been covering the legislature this week and last as the private option does or does not move through the chambers. Roby, it's been an eventful few days, hasn't it?
It has been an eventful few days, particularly early in the week, Kyle, but it feels like Groundhog Day now, just the movie where we see the same scene playing over and over and over again.
Well, as you and I talk, the House has twice voted and twice turned it down, but Davy Carter, who is the Speaker of the House, remains very confident and says they'll vote and vote and vote until it passes.
And he is saying that because obviously the House of Representatives needs, just like the Senate does, they need a 75% supermajority of votes to pass any funding bill, which means 75 members of the House have to support it. And right now they're anywhere from 68 to 73. If you look at the no votes, there's 27 no votes. So they've got to peel two of those no votes and get everybody else that's been voting present to vote for this funding appropriation. And so I think he feels confident that over time, and as the session wears down, and the fact that there's going to be less and less time to blow the budget up and start over again, and the fact that if you don't pass the private option funding in this larger appropriation bill for the Department of Human Services, you're going to be shutting down nursing homes in this state, and hospitals that rely on Medicaid are not going to get that funding, and the Conway Human Development Center, which works with some of the most severely disabled people in the state, will not get funding. There is no path for an alternative in terms of the number of votes for the opponents of the private option, and that's why Speaker Carter is confident that eventually he will wear them down and they will vote for it.
I imagine there have been some interesting negotiations over the past 48 to 72 hours.
I don't think there's much negotiation going on, to be honest with you, other than the negotiations that maybe the Senate will vote first and go ahead and pass it first and then send it down to the House to apply some additional pressure. But in terms of changes to the way the bill is drafted right now, Speaker Carter said he's non-negotiable and that the time to negotiate has long passed. You got to remember, they've been in pre-budget hearings for almost 2 months before the session started, and that was really the time to hammer a lot of these details out, and there were no objections raised at the time, per se. So he says we've had the time to negotiate this, and nobody showed up at the table when the meetings were taking place. We're not going to do it at the 11th hour, 59th minute now.
Still, if I'm a nay in the House and I look across the Capitol and I see that Jane English, a senator, had a negotiation and has now switched her vote, I'm tempted to think, well, maybe I could negotiate something that I like.
Well, you can try, but it blows the process up, and they got to start all over again because the bill would have to go back to the Joint Budget Committee. The amendment would have to be put on to the Joint Budget Committee, and there would have to come out of the Joint Budget Committee and back to the chambers for vote again. And there could be something unrelated to the private option that someone could use for some horse trading. And that may occur, but it would have to be more of a handshake and a promise that we're going to do that. And remember, Speaker Carter is term limited. He won't be here in the 2015 session, so he doesn't really have that negotiation power or that ability to deliver on a promise. It would have to be other leadership within the House or the Senate or the governor's office. But the governor's not going to be there in 2015 either, so I don't see that happening. It is within the realm of possibility, and it may be how they eventually get this eclipsed, but I haven't heard any talk of it at this point in time, and I don't know which members would be sitting on that fence and be able to be picked off like that.
Do you know or think there's been any discussion among Republicans? They are in the majority for the first time in both chambers since Reconstruction. If it turns into a mess, they certainly want, I don't think, would want that to be with them the first time they were the majority party in the legislature.
I agree, and I think that that is a conversation that has filled the halls of the Capitol. And look, we have been in charge of governing for the first time since Reconstruction, and we got to prove we can govern, guys, which they did in the 2013 session with the innovativeness of the private option. But to let government shut down or to not pass a major appropriation budget the size of the Department of Human Services, to walk away from that responsibility, I think, would really be a self-inflicted wound. When right now Republicans in this state, I feel like, have a lot of momentum building in the 2014 election cycle. The president's still unpopular. Healthcare.gov's rollout was unpopular, and it's still a big albatross on Democrats' necks. And so I just think it would be a self-inflicted wound if they were to not be able to get a budget passed when that's never been the case under Democratic rule in more than a century. So that's a dangerous game of chicken for them to play.
I'm curious. This is only the third fiscal session, and it seems like it's the one when Twitter and folks like Talk Business and John Brummett are able to report in real time. Do you think that has it made it any sort of different feel or environment at the Capitol?
I don't think it's changed legislative perspectives necessarily, but I think it has made just news more accessible to the mass public and people that like to follow, but they can't be up at the Capitol, you know, following every curve in the road. And so I think it's been a great resource for people who, you know, are capitalizing on this social media phenomenon and have been able to really keep up with developments on a real-time basis. I think it's been great. I think it's good for democracy. I think it's good for people to have that information and that understanding. And you still have to trust the resources that are providing you the information. So you can't believe everything that you see on Twitter or Facebook. But if you've got the credible sources and you have found them to be reliable in the past, then I think that you got a great opportunity to really keep up with things in a way that you haven't been able to before.
I want to switch gears for just a second. The Talk Business Hendricks poll hasn't had a chance to at least publish a poll since Tim Griffin announced he was running for lieutenant governor. We did see one poll that came out just a couple of days ago, and it indicates the soon-to-be former congressman is leading in all four congressional districts.
Not a surprise, really. I mean, Tim Griffin is a two-term congressman with name identification against a bunch of people who have either been state legislators or have never run for office before. So I do imagine that he would be the front runner in that race just out of pure name ID to start off with. So, yeah, I mean, I think he is one of the reasons why Republicans have gotten even more excited about their prospects for 2014. And back to my point earlier in the interview, to shut down government when you've got momentum like that. You've got a lieutenant governor's candidate now that can complete your governor's ticket. You've got Asa Hutchinson still either leading or tied in the polls and hanging in there. You've got Tom Cotton stretching out a little bit against Mark Breyer. These are all positive developments for Republicans, and to not govern effectively just, you know, pulls that momentum. It's a drag on it, and I don't know why they would want to do that.
Roby, thank you very much for your time.
Great to be with you, Kyle.
In about 25 minutes on Ozarks at Large, how to build an engineering company from a 600-square-foot garage in the Ozark countryside. You deliver some of the first machines you make yourself.
I would try to have several machines going to the same area at the same time. And that's what I do. I just drill holes in the truck bed and bolt them in, as many as I could fit in the back of the truck. And if it looked like it was going to rain, I'd wrap them up with Visqueen and put tape all around them, and away we'd go.
Our locally made series continues later with the story of Carson Engineering in Springdale. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Vladimir Putin has been hobnobbing with world leaders, confabbing with Team USA. Did Putin win a gold at the Games? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Tune to 91.3 FM for today's Here and Now. It begins this afternoon at 1 on KUAF.
Today, the City of Fayetteville Parks and Recreation Department has planned an event called Fruit Rootin'. The kickoff event for a new community orchard includes a groundbreaking ceremony as well as a workshop to help plant the new trees that will be in the orchard. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda headed to the site of the new orchard to learn more about the project.
The Yvonne Richardson Community Center is located in a valley just east of the downtown Fayetteville Square. The clock tower of the old Washington County Courthouse sits atop a hill to the west, while the Fayetteville Confederate Cemetery sits atop a hill to the east. On the grounds of the community center, you'll find a brightly colored playground structure, as well as a fenced-in area that serves the Kids Crops Youth Gardening Program. The open space between these two structures serves as the site of the Yvonne Richardson Community Center's Community Orchard. Part of the funding for the orchard came from a $5,000 community tree planting grant through Keep America Beautiful and the UPS Foundation. Derek Lynn, urban forester for the city's Parks Department, says the Richardson Center has been a community resource for decades.
We saw this as a natural fit here at the Yvonne Richardson Center, a nice central location here in the middle of town, and then also on a firm foundation with the existing programs here that are already in place with the groups of folks they already have here. And then also just to your side here up the hill is the Kid Crop Community Garden, and this has been a community garden for the last few years led by Roxanne and Jennifer, some staff at the Parks Department. And this is, through the growing season, a great kids program to get kids involved in learning where food comes from in the ground, all through teaching them how to cook food with it. They made pizza last year, and so we just see this as a great fit here from the community that already exists.
In his State of the City address last month, Mayor Lionel Jordan made mention of the city being awarded a grant to establish a community orchard for local consumption in an underserved area. At the time of the application in early 2013, Arkansas ranked first in the nation in percentage of food insecure households. Also at that time, 37% of children in Washington County were food insecure. The new community orchard consists of 12 trees. Two are pecan trees, Lynn says they acquired from a grower in Texas. The remaining ones are a combination of apple and pear trees that were donated by Ames Orchard and Nursery. Guy Ames is the owner of the nursery.
The big problem with pears is fire blight, so these are fire blight resistant pears. We've got three Asian pears. They're really yummy. And three different varieties of European type pears that have fire blight resistance. And then the apples, we've got two super early varieties that are really easy to grow. And then, of course, Arkansas Black. We have to have Arkansas Blacks. Oh, and Arkansas. We've got another, actually, Arkansas's oldest heirloom variety, dates back to 1834, called Arkansas with a W.
Ames focuses on growing plants without pesticides and says the trees he has donated can be grown without pesticides and fungicides. In addition to his nursery, Ames also does work for the National Center for Appropriate Technology. While he doesn't remember exactly how he and Lynn met, he does know that he just happened to be working on a publication about community orchards when he learned about the one being planned for Fayetteville. According to this publication, the community orchard movement began in the early 1990s in England. The first community orchards were abandoned, privately owned orchards that were in danger of dying from neglect or being pushed out by development. These orchards were saved by citizens who were concerned about a number of things, including green space, the survival of old varieties, local history, healthy eating, and the beauty of the landscape. Ames says the trees in the Fayetteville orchard are 1 and 2 years old and will take a little bit of time before they produce fruit.
Arkansas Black is non-precocious, as the pomologist would say. It doesn't bear very early. Okay, but some of these are precocious. Shinko Asian pear that's going to be in here is very precocious, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's fruit on it in a couple of years. So it varies a lot by these varieties. Magnus is real shy to come into bearing, but some of these other pears will come in fast. Of the apples, the Pristine and the Williams Pride will come in pretty quickly.
To help protect the trees, urban forester Derek Lynn says they will take a number of precautionary steps. For example, they are going to erect a fence to help keep deer away. They will also place protective wraps around the bottom portion of the tree's trunks to help protect from other types of wildlife. To help keep weeds down and maintain moisture after being watered, the trees will be surrounded by a ring of mulch. Guy Ames will also come to the orchard to give pruning workshops to local residents, and he says hopefully the community will eventually take that part over. Looking forward, Ames says he would love to see more of these orchards in the area. He says community orchards can be beneficial in a number of ways. They can serve as a site for social gatherings, such as weddings and family reunions. They can also provide educational opportunities, a tranquil place to relax, and of course, they provide food.
Hopefully, someday there'll be a lot of fruit. And there'll be an opportunity for the community here to decide what they want to do with the fruit. The community orchard is, you know, I'm involved here at the first, Derek's here involved at the first, but ultimately we hope the community will be making these decisions, and hopefully someday they'll have to fight over what they're going to do with the harvest. It'd be a good problem to have, and I suspect we will have it. So that'll be one of the things, too. I'd like to think that some of the surplus would go to food pantries and things like that. So and then, of course, here's the Yvonne Richardson Center with these kids. You know, we can do cooking here, you know, preserving even. So, yeah, I see that happening, too.
Lynn agrees that when the trees do produce food, it will benefit the local community.
The food goes to the community, the folks that are out here taking care of it and enjoying it, the youth that are out here. I'm sure kids, we hope the kids' crops students will be able to enjoy the fruits. Like Guy said, if we have a surplus, another one of the visions with this type of undertaking is to be able to help make an impact on food security in the community as well. And so we want this to be seen as a way to help empower folks to understand how they can grow their own tasty food themselves.
To see the community orchard for yourself, you can head to 240 East Rock Street in Fayetteville. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
The Biology Graduate Student Association at the University of Arkansas has invited Michael Dorcas, herpetologist and professor at Davidson College in North Carolina, to speak this afternoon at 4 in room 604 of the Science Building. Dorcas's research focuses on the ecology and conservation of amphibians and reptiles. This morning, he stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss one of his areas of study, invasive pythons in the Everglades National Park. Burmese pythons should not be living in the wild in the United States, but hobbyists tend to keep them as pets, and because people either let them out or because they've escaped, they are in the wild and causing quite the problem. Dorcas began our conversation by telling a bit about this very large snake.
Burmese pythons are certainly one of the largest snakes in the world. The record size that's been found in Everglades National Park is around a little over 18 feet. But there have been, you know, several snakes that have been found that are over 17, and then you got, you know, more and more as you go down. But certainly a large female python, the females get larger than the males, can approach, you know, potentially 20 feet.
And how big around?
It's going to vary depending on their reproductive status. If it's a female that, you know, has just laid eggs, she might be relatively thin, but they might be as big around as, you know, certainly a large person's thigh, you know, that kind of thing.
I never thought I was scared of snakes. And I went to the reptile museum that we have here. I mean, it's just a guy that, you know, it's essentially his, you know, kind of personal collection of reptiles.
Sure.
But, yeah, I was a little freaked out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, they're snakes like any other snake. And so they're, you know, the danger they pose to humans is probably very, very small. But it certainly is possible that, you know, a wild python could kill a human. It happens in captivity. People that keep these large snakes in captivity every few years, you know, you see the news and there's somebody that's killed by their pet python. And usually it's the python, you know, it's feeding time and the snake gets a hold of them or, you know, something related to that. You know, the snake is normally a very docile snake, but it mistakes, you know, them for food. And you know, if a large snake like that gets wrapped around you, it can certainly kill you.
And that's how they kill their prey, is by constricting.
Yeah, they're constrictors. So they bite their prey and get a hold of it with their mouth, wrap around it, and essentially, you know, kill it that way. But, you know, we have many constrictors here that are native to the United States. You mentioned, you know, black snakes or black rat snakes are constrictors. King snakes are constrictors. You know, so there are many snakes, not just pythons and boas, that use that technique to kill their prey.
So they don't really pose a threat to humans. What kinds of problems are they causing in the Everglades?
Well, they pose a very low threat to humans. That's for sure. But the main problem that appears to be that we're documenting is the impact on native fauna, and specifically the impacts that we've seen on common mammals. And so we've seen both temporally, both before and after pythons have proliferated, and spatially, based on where they have expanded their range, declines, very severe declines, in once very common species of mammals that are consistent with pythons as being the reason that these animals have disappeared. And so, for example, we've, you know, in Everglades National Park, there are 99% fewer raccoons than there were before pythons proliferated, you know, 99% fewer possums, you know, 87% fewer bobcats. Rabbits appear to be essentially eliminated from ever, you know, large portions of Everglades National Park. So there appear to be just across the board species that were once very common to see, you know, that have just been nearly removed from the park. And it's very consistent with pythons as the major factor affecting them.
Those are huge percentage.
Yes.
I mean, that's
very huge.
Huge.
Right, exactly. And so the next question, you know, obviously is, well, if you remove, if you have those kind of declines in these mammals, what, you know, are the cascading effects that that has on the ecosystem overall? And so we're starting to do some research to start examining those kinds of things as well. But those kinds of, you know, anytime you have a food web that's as complex as that we have in the Everglades, it's really difficult to predict ahead of time exactly what the impacts of altering, you know, the abundances in such a drastic way can be.
Michael Dorcas is a herpetologist and professor at Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. He'll speak on the University of Arkansas campus this afternoon at 4 in room 604 of the Science Building. You can look forward to a longer conversation with Dorcas on a coming edition of Ozarks at Large.
Trying to figure out who you are isn't always easy.
We fight for identity, sometimes we kill for identity, but why is that?
As long as you experience your condition as an identity, It's the source of your freedom.
I would say that my home is where I find my identity, which is an ongoing phenomenon.
The journey to understanding identity on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
That's Sunday at noon on 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. In just a few minutes, we meet the students that make up the regional Quiz Bowl champion team.
But first, a couple of items of note. Yesterday, Walton Arts Center announced the cancellation of the Jim Belushi and the Chicago Board of Comedy performance. That performance was scheduled for Thursday, April 10th. Mr. Belushi has accepted a film role, which conflicts with the performance at Walton Arts Center. Mr. Belushi extended his sincere apologies to his fans in a letter in which he says, "It's a great role. It's a must-do. It's an opportunity that if I don't seize, I feel I will regret the rest of my career. We want to be in Arkansas. We want to play Arkansas. Thank you for your understanding, and I hope that you will all go out and see the movie." There are no plans to reschedule. The box office will contact ticket holders directly with options to donate the value of the tickets, exchange into another performance, or receive a full refund.
Matthew McClure, executive chef of The Hive inside 21C Museum Hotel in Bentonville, has been nominated for a James Beard Award. The nominees for the annual awards were announced yesterday, and Matt is among those in the running for Best Chef in the South. He's among 12 semifinalists for the award. He's a Little Rock native who, after studying at the New England Culinary Institute and working in a number of Boston restaurants, returned home to work under Lee Richardson at the Capitol Hotel in Little Rock. He opened The Hive, which bills itself as country cooking all grown up, last February. The James Beard Awards are the Oscars of the culinary world. Winners announced Tuesday, March 18th.
Many students compete on an athletic front, running track, playing basketball, soccer, football, competitive dance, even swimming. But participating in sports is not the only arena for students to compete. Earlier this month, students on Fayetteville's Woodland Junior High School's Quiz Bowl team beat several area schools to win a spot in the Arkansas Governor's Quiz Bowl Association State Championship this Saturday. I spoke with the 10-member team to learn a bit about the sport and how they prepare for such a tournament. Eighth grader Kyle Mayer's area of expertise is current events. This is Kyle's first year for Quiz Bowl.
I had noticed through my academic career that I had accumulated more knowledge and I guess was more knowledgeable about certain topics than some of my peers. And I had known that Quiz Bowl had been an outlet for those. I just don't know if I was comfortable enough with my self and what that I knew to go and compete with that, but I think this year's really been a confidence booster for me with Quiz Bowl.
Winning can definitely be a confidence booster. Excelling in academics is common among this group of kids. Quiz Bowl is a competition much like Jeopardy, with a lot of knowledge questions in a variety of subjects. But this is a team Jeopardy, with five members per one of two teams competing, able to buzz in and answer the questions. One of two coaches, Lindsay Asbury, says the subject matter is broken up into percentages.
Typically, it's going to be about 20% math questions, 20% history, geography kinds of questions, 20% science, 20% language, and then the other 20% is just random, any kind of knowledge. And so, but when you say 20% science, that could range anything from biology, chemistry, physics, computer science. I mean, so it could range so much within that general topic. So even within I'm going to study science, it's such a broad topic to consider, considering all the things that could entail.
To prepare, the students have an optional study session each Thursday afternoon, followed by practice on Friday. All kids say they also use an Apple app called QuizUp, in which they compete with others all over the world to answer questions. Ninth grader Sophie Harris says that studying for Quiz Bowl is more than just reading a textbook.
Yeah, I guess you can't really study for Quiz Bowl. I mean, you can study, like, certain areas, but it's more like just having a broad range of knowledge and, like, anticipating questions is a big thing we study. Just, like if you hear part of a question, just knowing what it's going to ask or knowing if it's going to, like, spell a certain word. And so, yeah, just anticipating the questions.
Practice is also competition. Ms. Asbury and her co-coach, Mr. Campbell, keep Quiz Bowl stats to track which students are best at science and other subjects, so the students know who has answered the most questions and in which categories. These stats help determine which five students will go up to the competition table first, though all 10 students will, hopefully, get a chance to play. All did at the regional competition earlier this month. One of two co-captains, ninth grader Ryan Kim, says that that competition also served as preparation.
Like, I guess where we gain more experience, as in like playing more games, like actual official games together, so we know, like, because this tournament will kind of be similar to the state tournament, so we're kind of now used to, like, the type of questions they're going to ask and the format. So.
Albert Chu joins him.
A lot of it's about what you're up against, knowing what you're up against. Since we've throughout the year, we've played a lot of the teams that we will be facing up in Little Rock. We know what we're up against, so we know if we're supposed to go at it really fast, try to get the questions from them, because they might be really fast. Like, for example, Conway, they are extremely fast to the buzzer, so we have to get our speed on there.
Conway, they say, is their biggest rival, who they have lost to in the past. Though it wouldn't hurt to beat Ramey, Woodland's crosstown rival in Fayetteville. Other co-captain Jacob Partridge says playing another team multiple times has its advantages, and though they are rivals, the kids manage to keep it civil.
We've become sort of familiar with the different players' strengths, like, on the opposite team, but it's pretty friendly, like, when the competition isn't going on, like, between teams. Like, we have friends from the other school and everything, but it can get sort of intense mid-game.
When a question is asked during competition, each student on either team has an equal chance of answering that question. But the one who hits his or her buzzer first gets the first chance to answer correctly. And speed counts. Here's Sophie Harris.
Well, math computations, like math problems where you work out a problem, I think they give you 20 seconds. And then other questions, 10 seconds? 5 seconds,
five.
Yes.
5 seconds.
Yeah. You just have to be quick, and if you know the answer, buzz.
Math, evidently, is a strong suit for this team, with members rarely needing the full 20 seconds to get a question right. Eighth grader Ibby Arkton says the time constraints really get the adrenaline flowing.
Honestly, it just kind of feels like all your senses are supercharged, and often a lot of people seem to do better in competitions than they do in practice. I don't know what it is. I'm like that, and I know a few other people who are like that, but competition just seems to bring out the best in us.
Co-captain Ryan Kim says keeping that adrenaline at bay is one of his duties as captain.
It's like a lot of leadership. Like, you have to calm the team down during, like, certain rounds where we have to collaborate and not, like, freak out that we might be down by, like, 30 points and we need to come back, and that we need to keep our confidence. And you just have to be, like, a team player and try to combine our, like, interests and our areas of expertise and, like, do well in all aspects.
To keep spirits up and momentum flowing, all members wear a team t-shirt to competitions. They bear the atomic signs for sulfur, tungsten, and silver, which spell out swag. They also have a lucky charm of sorts. An old boot found in a parking lot has been dubbed the swag boot. The swag boot will be making the trek to Little Rock on Saturday. The team's day will begin by rising at 4 a.m., meeting at Woodland at 5, and driving to the Arkansas Governor's Quiz Bowl Junior High State Tournament. On the drive, they will be asking each other questions, playing Quiz Up, or listen to some motivational music. Co-captain Jacob Partridge explains their expected day. As a ninth grader, he knows, because Woodland won this tournament last year.
They'll use our scores and our win-loss record in our morning games to put us into a bracket and get, you know, appropriate seedings done for the afternoon competition. And so normally we'll go out to lunch while, you know, the tournament officials create the bracket. And then when we come back, they'll have us seated and the bracket all ready and made out. And we'll immediately go into the tournament and begin playing. And from then on, it's single elimination, you know. Like, you lose, you can still do sort of well, but championship, you need to go undefeated in the afternoon.
10 points are given for each correct answer. I asked the students to provide me with some example questions, to which some obliged.
You know, what's the capital of Mali? You know, go Timbuktu on that one. To, like, names of planets, different moons is something that I've been trying to harness in the Thursday study sessions. And so that's been helpful in competition.
Yeah, the one I have off the top of my head is like a science question. It's like, what kind of combustion releases heat? And it'd be like, what was it, enthalpy? It's like something I learned in chemistry. It's like really random stuff. So.
Well, you could go like, which element is number 30 on the periodic table or something.
I remember last game, we missed a question that I was sitting out on that I'm pretty confident I would have gotten, not to gloat or anything, but it was, which Cleveland man in 2013 abducted Michelle Knight and held her captive? I don't know how many years it was, but once I heard Cleveland man and Michelle Knight, I was ready to say Ariel Castro, but unfortunately I was not in on that round.
Many questions surround current events, so of course I asked where they get their news. The answers varied from Diane Sawyer, CBS News, to CNN. But I did get the answer I was looking for, sort of. At least one echoed my junior high self.
Yeah, my mom's pretty big on listening to the radio when we're driving places. I don't really appreciate it as much as she does, but...
Yeah, my mom has NPR News on in the morning. So.
NPR app.
Yeah, I listen to NPR in the morning.
Sophie Harris, Albert Chu, Jacob Honeycutt, Jacob Partridge, Stephen Du, Ryan Kim, Kyle Maurer, David Vega, Aubin Payne, and Ibby Arkton, along with Coach Lindsay Asbury, make up the Woodland Junior High Quiz Bowl team. They hope to bring home the state championship trophy from Little Rock on Saturday. And if funds are raised, the team hopes to travel to a national tournament in Chicago in June.
This is Ozarks at Large. Once a month, we take a few minutes to highlight something locally made. Most of our finds have been creations you can readily see, hold, or find, like custom-made signs, furniture, or cards. But this month, our locally made spotlight turns to something you may never have seen or given much thought.
Tube-forming machines and tooling, and do the... application engineering to make these machines do what the customers need to make their product.
Jim Carson is the founder and former president of Carson Engineering, located in Springdale. You've probably never held something made by Carson, but it's hard to fathom you haven't been affected by their work, probably even today. While Carson Engineering doesn't make the air conditioner in your home or office, those units probably wouldn't be working without Carson products and solutions. Brad Minter, the current president of the company, explains the reach of the materials and tools produced by Carson.
The companies that buy our equipment, they produce a wide range of products. But if you go into a big box store, the air conditioning units on the roof have components that have been produced on our equipment. If you grab a soda out of one of the small cases by the register, those they use our equipment to produce their product, whether it's the cooling the water in a drinking fountain, soft serve ice cream machines, drink dispensers, and of course not to mention the air conditioners in your home. It's a wide range.
The company's customers include the big, like Train and Carrier, but also some of the smallest. Those small customers were some of the first. While Carson Engineering now has a shop and several employees in Springdale, the beginning was modest. Jim Carson says around age 40, he and his wife Barbara agreed he could leave his corporate job as a manufacturing engineer and machine and tool designer to start his own business. Barbara's career in nursing could allow him, they decided, to pursue the dream. He began in his 600-square-foot garage in the eastern Washington County countryside. Barb and Jim still had three children in school at the time. Jim Carson now recalls that the new venture was stepping out into the unknown. He didn't want to borrow much money for a business he says he didn't know for sure would work.
I was able to buy a milling machine, a Bridgeport mill, and I had credit at Sears so I could buy a few of the small tools we needed. I had a drawing board. I put a wall down in the center so I could have design on one side, build on the other side, and away we went.
He says the first year was one of development and experimentation, and it was a family affair. He recruited his daughter, Sandy, to help keep the books in 1981. She says in those early days, her father couldn't capture the attention of the biggest potential customers, so they started selling to smaller companies, including many in East Texas.
where the style of doing business was a lot different. And so we were able to get into these smaller shops and get our products in there. And even sometimes Dad would say, hey, I'm going to bring you this machine because I think you need it. And if you don't like it, I will come back and pick it up. If you like it, then you can send me the check. And so that's one way we were able to get our foot in the door.
Sandy stuck with the company. She's now the vice president of sales and administration. Jim Carson says those early trips were often sales calls made on faith that potential clients would like what Jim had created in his garage. He'd load up his machines into the back of his 1977 Ford 150 pickup.
I could get to know the people in the factories who were actually operating the machines. I could kind of make a splash when I came up to the door, and I'd have machines bolted into the back of the truck, as many as I could. We had a string of customers, especially as Sandy mentioned, there in East Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and down in Jacksonville, and those little towns there. And so I would try to have several machines going to the same area at the same time. And that's what I do. I just drill holes in the truck bed and bolt them in, as many as I could fit in the back of the truck. And if it looked like it was going to rain, I'd wrap them up with Visqueen and put tape all around them, and away we'd go.
Jim says he thinks he made a sale every time he made one of those excursions. Sandy says some of the bigger players in the industry began noticing his work and making inquiries. The company grew and in 2003 moved to the space in Springdale. Inside the shop at Carson Engineering, several machines are sitting waiting for delivery. Justin Walker, vice president and engineering manager at Carson, points to some large machinery, recently built and freshly painted.
Brazil, Fort Worth, Texas. This one's going to
Norman, Oklahoma.
This one's going to Norman, Oklahoma. That one's going to Marshalltown, Iowa.
One in the box is going to
Czech Republic.
Yeah, Czech Republic. Sure is, yeah.
Justin, who began working at Carson Engineering as a high school student in the 1980s, says another machine nearby is an indication of how important the Springdale company has been to the industry. The machine is called a two-hole punch and was designed by Jim. Justin says the machine is revolutionary.
For many years, if somebody wanted to put a hole in a piece of tube, if you look inside your air conditioner, you would see, especially the condenser coil, which is on the outside. If you look in there, you would see this long tube that's got holes in it, and that connects eventually to the coil. And so for many years, if somebody wanted a hole in that, they would just set it up on a drill press and drill a hole in it. And so there's a couple bad things about that. It produced a lot of burrs. It was somewhat dangerous, and it was slow. And so Jim designed a process by which a hole could be punched, just by brute force, punched in that piece of tubing. And it's so much faster. The waste material can be reclaimed and recycled. And it's not dangerous.
Though Jim Carson has retired, he still refers to the company and the company's employees as we. He says developing an engineering company from the ground up requires a bit of confidence, hard work, time to sleep or not sleep on ideas and concepts. He says meeting a payroll provides some inspiration, too, when trying to figure out how to create, improve, or fix a machine.
You're looking to somehow find a solution, and miraculously sometimes it shows up. And then to design, you also have to have a certain amount of courage, because you got to accept that you're going to do some things, figure out some things that look great, and then when you actually build them, turn them into hardware, son of a gun, they don't work.
Until, of course, more time is spent tweaking that machine. Brad Minter, the current president, says all of Jim's plans and ideas have been meticulously saved and filed. Brad says inspiration and work ethic are important, but so is institutional memory.
When you start a small company, you don't realize how important it is to document everything. And Jim and Sandy set up a system to document all of our work, all of our drawings. And to this day, we can go back and lay our hands on the hard copies of drawings and jobs and work that we did 30 years ago, and we can replicate that.
Carson Engineering is located in Springdale, and their work is all over the world. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, February 20th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas, and with me now is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, now some music that I know what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, that's exciting.
Last week, I got to talk to Helen Reddy.
Okay, I don't, the name sounds familiar.
I Am Woman.
Okay.
It was a huge anthem hit. I think it came out in 71 or 72, mm-hmm. and everyone sang it, every woman sang it pumping their fist in the air. She retired about 10 years ago. She had lots of other hits, did Broadway, did TV. She retired and was living in Sydney. She's from Australia. Mm-hmm. And had gone back to school and was practicing clinical hypnotherapy and neuro-linguistic programming.
It's pretty serious.
As a retirement career. And then her sister had a birthday party.
Okay.
There's just the two of them. They grew up in vaudeville. And her sister was turning 80 and said, "Hey, I want you to sing with me." She sang and went, "Hey, that doesn't sound half bad. I think I'll go back to work for a while."
Third career.
So she's back in the States and has been touring, and she will be at the Alma Performing Arts Center at 8 o'clock on Saturday. She says audience will get a chance to hear some of her stories and some of their favorite songs, Delta Dawn, Leave Me Alone, Ruby Red Dress, Keep On Singing, You and Me Against the World, and some of the ballad and story songs that she really likes. And, of course, she will sing I Am Woman. Tickets are $25 to $40 at 632-2129.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hello, I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night from 10 till midnight. In the background is the New York Standards Quartet, reinterpreting the classic composition by John Coltrane, Giant Steps. We'll hear more of their music this Friday. We'll also hear from Chucho Valdez and Wallace Roney, the Either Orchestra, Elmo Hope, and much more. Tune in this Friday for Shades of Jazz.
The Fayetteville Mardi Gras celebration begins with a family-friendly Parade of Fools, March 1st at 2 p.m. on the downtown square. And the Demented Crew of Dixon Street's Mardi Gras celebration for adults is March 4th from 4 to 8 p.m. It includes the coronation of the King and Queen. For more information, FayettevilleMardiGras.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Waldron.
Waldron, down south from us.
County seat of Scott County.
All right, there you go.
All right.
On yesterday's edition of Ozarks at Large, Antoinette Grajeda posed a trivia question for our listeners. The question was, when was the last time Berlin hosted the Olympics?
And the answer is 1936.
Right. We asked listeners to email in, and we chose one at random. And the winner is?
Julie Siebert.
Congratulations to Julie Siebert. She has won four tickets to Leo. That's a 10 by 10 performance at the Walton Arts Center tomorrow evening.
Your tickets for that will be at Will Call at Walton Arts Center.
Right, under your name. You also win four tickets to a screening of War Horse at the Malco Theater in Fayetteville.
Right.
And then also four tickets to any Malco movie.
Right.
And you can choose. That's Julie's
right.
choosing when she wants to go.
So we've planned your weekend for you.
Pretty much.
Congratulations,
Pretty
Julie.
Pretty much. There you go.
Julia. Julia.
Julia.
Julia Siebert.
All right.
Who correctly guessed 1936.
All right. Well, Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
You and Antoinette will be back together tomorrow, Friday.
That is right, for a brand new show that begins at noon. And then you, me, Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks
That's
at Large.
That's right. All right. Well, until then, thank you so much for listening, and have a good Thursday.